Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network.
And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score, which would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and its Memorabilia, the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network. In conjunction with Slick Enterprises, and we're live from the Southport, North Carolina home, Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Slick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America which focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia. Find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. It's at this time I'd like to introduce my special guest, co-host. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football, memorabilia, and card collector and historian that has one of the most advanced collections in the country of pre-World War II items, in particular of the 1925 Pottsville Maroons. A friend to both the magazine and our podcast, I'd like to welcome once again guest co-host, Mr. Jeff Payne. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Hey, Bob, how you doing? It's good to be back on and really looking forward to this show. I think it's going to be a great one.
Thanks for filling in. As a aside, Joe has sent his regards from the country of Qatar, where he is there for the other football game. He's at the World Cup for the next week and a half or so. So he's set to say hi to everybody. And again, thank you for filling in his semi.
No worries. Hope he has safe travels. And I was wondering if he was going to try to get over there. I know he went last time.
Yeah, he was going to last time something happened, and then he never made it. Mm. Or I think COVID hit or whatever, and then now he made the plans. So I talked to him last night out of Calgary when he was waiting for a flight. So he's set to say hi to everybody, and he'll be back in a few weeks. Well, Jeff, we have a very interesting show coming up, but before we get started with our special guest, we're going to talk a little bit about the 1959 Bazooka football card set, a set I've owned several cards over the years from, and a very, very difficult set to complete in any condition. And I'll hand off to you on it.
Great set. Great set, Bob. One of my favorite non-mainstream sets. I just love everything about this set. You know, those that aren't familiar with it, don't know it much. It is a tall boy set. You know, we always talk about the 1965 top set being, you know, the tall boy set, but people forget that the 59 Bazooka set, and Bazooka, of course, was owned by Topps, was another tall boy set. Now, it was distributed differently. than their mainstream sets. The Bazooka set, you know, roughly the same size as the Tall Boys on 65, kind of right around 5 inches tall, you know, a little over 2 inches wide. But these were distributed on the bottoms of Bazooka gum boxes in the 50s and 60s. You know, Topps was selling, obviously, their Penny Bazooka gum with Bazooka Joe comics in it, but they also would, you know, distribute larger boxes that had, you know, 20-piece or 25-piece, you know, pieces of gum in it, and they were big enough that you could put a Tall Boy on the bottom of the boxes, and that's how the 59 Bazookas were distributed. Great set. Love the clean, simple design. You know, I'm a big fan of nice, simple designs, and I love the design on the Bazooka set. The player images are big, obviously, because it's a Tall Boy. You know, almost all of the shots are of players from kind of the waist up, so you see their jerseys, their jersey numbers. You know, nice big headshots, a lot of detail, very colorful. Just love the look of those, you know, of those cards. They've got a, you know, team logo on the bottom, their name and their, you know, their affiliation, their team. And that's pretty much it. There's nothing on the backs. They're blank backs. So real simple, easy design. But just love them. And as you mentioned, hard. Hard to find and hard to complete as a set. You know, one of the things that... Go ahead, Bob.
No, I was going to say, the one thing I do remember, the 71 Bazooka football card set, which I did buy a few boxes. I do distinctly remember buying the boxes, but I cut the cards from the back. I didn't keep the backs pristine, not realizing they would be so valuable down the road. But I did cut up the cards off the box. The 59 Bazooka set, I was only 1 year old, so obviously I had no recollection of it whatsoever until years later. And according to my notes here, I didn't actually see one in person until a show back in 1988 back in Connecticut. Hmm. And that's pretty interesting. I didn't purchase one until the late 90s. And then I bought a couple, and I ended up selling them, trading them over the years. All right, back to you.
Yeah, no, very, very, very hard to find for whatever reason. You know, Topps/Bazooka had put out a baseball set earlier in the spring of 59. And I believe that was the first time they had put sports cards on a Bazooka box. And apparently it was such a hit that they actually added more baseball players to the boxes. And then as they got close to the fall, they decided to do a football set as well. Same exact look and feel for the most part as the baseball ones. But, you know, for whatever reason, the football ones are, I would say, much, much more difficult than the baseball ones are. And there's only 18 cards in the set, so it's not like a very big set. But yet, you know, you talk to many advanced collectors, and there's just cards in that set they've never seen, right? Which is, you know, which is interesting, to say the least.
Yeah, it's a very, very difficult set. And again, trying to find them more so raw than graded, because I really don't see what the advantages of getting them graded, because you know, it's unless you got a pristine box that you cut it from, then you're not going to get a high grade on it one way or the other. And again, it's not the type of set, in my opinion, that should be high graded in the first place, because it saw a lot of use over the years, and how many of those boxes actually survived over the years is minimal, to say the least. So it's a fascinating set. It's real fascinating to me. Collecting-wise, it's just a fascinating set overall. And, again, it's I know a lot of team set collectors have you know, one or two cards off of that set that they're trying to collect for their team player collections and individual player, like a Unitas or whatever.
There's at least one card, even though it's a small set, there's at least one card of a player from all 12 NFL teams from that era. So if you're collecting, you know, team sets, there's at least one 59 Bazooka that you're going to have to snag. You mentioned grading these things. The cards on the back of the boxes do have a dashed line around them to help, you know, guide, you know, kids, primarily, I'm sure, in 59, with cutting them off the box in straight lines and trying to make them look pretty good. That has caused a challenge with grading these cards. There's a lot of confusion and a lot of inconsistency with how these cards are graded. You know, if you look at the PSA, what they say about their hand-cut cards, if they do have some sort of a guide, some sort of a, you know, box around or dashed lines around it, in order to get a numerical grade, you're supposed to either have cut outside of those lines all the way around, or at least some part of that dashed line needs to be shown on all four sides, and it has to meet size requirements. But I can tell you from experience, there's a lot of cards out there that you look at and you say, well, based on that criteria, this should not have gotten a numerical grade and it was given one. Or by that criteria, you say it should have gotten one and it wasn't. So, you know, a lot of confusion about, you know, how to get these things graded. You know, kind of, you know, submitter beware if you have, you know, raw bazookas and you go and try to get them graded. You might get a surprise with the result.
Well, you know, again, everybody knows my feelings on grading and graded cards, but at the same time, I just don't understand the logic of why you would want to grade a 59 bazooka or 71 bazooka football card. I just don't get it. And if anything, I would want to collect, if I had unlimited funds, try to find the actual full complete box flat and collect them that way. You know what I mean? Almost like a 78 Slim Jim set where, you know, it's challenging to collect the entire box as compared to just the disc on the back at the same time. So it's an interesting set. Again, it's got a lot of possibilities to it. I've always liked the bazookas. The closest I ever was a 71 bazooka set, and then I just kept a few cards out of that over the years because it was just became too difficult to try to find them one way or the other. And again, 71 bazooka was another, not to take away from the 59 bazooka, but there are more 71 bazookas around than there are 59. But again,
a lot more.
59 bazooka is just a classic football card set. And given the time frame of 1959, a pro football was really coming into play with the AFL in 1960. The history behind the set on top of it is just amazing to me. And again, I've always liked, as you know, oddball food type issues, candy issues, and that just says it all. Has all the criteria for just a classic football card set.
And there is a couple of errors in the set. One was corrected. So Charlie Connerly, who was QB of the New York Giants. There is also a version of that card that has him listed with the Baltimore Colts. So we also know because of that that they did multiple runs. And that might be why some of the cards seem to be short prints, that seem to be a lot harder. We don't know how many runs they did of prints, but we do know that error was corrected. So that's a difficult card to find is the error card for Charlie Connerly that has him with the Colts. The other error was not corrected. So poor Woodley Lewis, who played for the Cardinals, Rams, first on the inaugural team of the Cowboys. Topps could never get his name right. So they called him Woody on his 59 bazooka card. His name's Woodley. Wood, L-E-Y. I think in 58 on his regular card, they called him Woodley, but they left the E off. They called him Woody on another card. I think it wasn't until 1960 that they actually spelled his name right. So that was never corrected, probably because they didn't even know that it was spelled wrong, I guess, which is pretty funny. I always get asked, like, which card's the hardest one to find, and that's pretty clear. It's Tom Tracy of the Steelers, you know, Tom the Bomb, as they used to call him. That card is just impossible to find. I was fortunate enough to pick one up, and I did complete this set probably 8 years ago. But that card, I've only ever seen, I think, one or two others in the last decade come up anywhere.
Right.
It's just really hard to find for whatever reason.
I've never seen it except for, and I don't remember the auction that it was in, and I remember we talked about it years ago. It was coming to auction, and I'm sure there's going to be a bidding war between people completing and trying to complete the complete set and Steelers team sets collectors in a strong battle for that card. I have never seen that card at any show I've ever attended in I don't know how many years, almost 40 years of going. Just truly amazing card, to say the least. But
I was just gonna say, and it was not in the recently. There was a near complete set that got broken up and auctioned off, and duly noted was there was no Tom Tracy in that near complete set that was broken up. There was the error card of Connerly's that was corrected was in there, and his other one. And Groza, who's another tough one, was in there, but no Tom Tracy.
Yeah, exactly. But it just has all the flavors to a great classic football set. It's a great set. And again, the times I held the type cards in there, I just said I'm never going to put this set together. I'd rather see it go to sell it to somebody who's actually trying to pursue the set or a team set at the same time. It's a classic set, real classic set. The other, we're totally unrelated to it though. The San Giorgio flip chart card set from that year. I have never seen one ever. I don't even remember seeing any in auction over the years. I don't know how it exists. You know what I mean? That's another amazing set from 1959 that I don't know anyone. Maybe possibly one person that I know of that may have one of them. But I've never seen them
yeah.
at all. And
I believe they're all Redskins, right? Are they all Washington Redskins? Yeah, I've only seen the LeBaron, and that was just an image from someone who has it. I've never actually seen it come up on eBay or at auction anywhere.
No.
You know, that one's impossible as well.
That's a great trip down memory lane with the 1959 Bazooka set. And just a great classic football card set, to say the least. Our special guest is here, and I'd like to introduce him to our audience, and we've got a lot to talk about. Our special guest tonight is a pediatric dentist. He's an undergraduate of the University of Cincinnati Dental School. Undergraduate from the University of Cincinnati. He attended dental school at Ohio State, did his residency at the Cincinnati Children's Hospital. He's married to his high school sweetheart of 30 years, Peggy, and has two wonderful children, John and Isabella. He lives in his hometown, enjoying his family career, golf, and the hobby. He has collected since he was 6 years old, when he started dumpster diving with his grandfather, finding old toys, guns, clothes, beer cans, and much more. They would hang out at flea markets and swap meets. His grandfather could sell anything, and he loved junking with him. He's collected 19th century football and baseball since high school. His first 19th century piece was a pair of fingerless baseball gloves. However, his passion is 19th century football and baseball and digging up 19th century football history. At this time, I'd like to welcome our special guest to our show this evening, Mr. John Genantonio. John, welcome to the show.
Don't hear John.
Can you hear me now?
There you are.
Yeah.
Okay.
I tried out a new pair of headsets. I just wanted to say thanks, Bob and Jeff, for hosting me. It's quite an honor speaking with the two of you. Such wonderful, knowledgeable guys, football historians and collectors. I'm not worthy, but I'll do my best. Remember, you're talking to a dumpster diver here.
Hey, we all started that way, I suspect.
You're more than worthy. But let's start off by, if you could tell our audience how you became interested in football and collecting.
Sure. I think, you know, my dad and my grandfather, they were huge influences on my life, as most guys. And my dad was always very supportive of all aspects of my life. He assisted me with my beer can collecting when I was younger, my G.I. Joes, my baseball and football cards. He was a season ticket holder of the Bengals, going back to their inception in 1868 when Paul Brown brought the team to town. And I've been a lifelong Bengals fan, for better or for worse. Before I was in elementary school, my grandfather would take me junking. And when we dumpster dive, it was mainly me dumpster diving. And, man, the things that I found in those dumpsters, you know, we were behind, stores, sporting goods stores, toy stores. And, you know, I guess things that people returned back in the day, they didn't have a problem throwing a gun away. And I dug out guns and G.I. Joes, and it was just amazing. But I think that's where I got bitten by the bug, you know, hanging out with my grandfather, hanging out at flea markets. He was like the Sanford son of our family. You know, he found everything and he could sell anything, you know. So in my teens and 20s, I gravitated towards the College Football Hall of Fame. We had it here in town. It was close to where I lived. I'd ride my moped there, and I would pester the heck out of Pat Quinn and Ken Stevens. So Pat was the curator, Kent was one of his associates, and Kent's still around, and we do talk on occasion. I loved looking at their early football ephemera, the programs, the tickets, the pictures. The 3D objects were just amazing to me, the old jerseys, uniforms, balls, and trophies. And I think that's when I fell in love with the evolution of football. And that's kind of how I've collected. I've collected with the idea I want to get earlier. I want to find the earliest document, the earliest scrap, the earliest element of football. That's kind of where my passion is, at least right now.
That's incredible, wow. John. And you are definitely worthy of being on the show. You could be running the show, too.
No.
Your stuff is awesome. I've seen some of your stuff, and you just have jaw-dropping things. And it's kind of interesting to hear how you got and gravitated back to the 1800s. It sounds like that all kind of came out of, hanging out at the Hall of Fame. Is that really the way you transitioned from kind of, you know, as a
sure.
kid collecting – stuff, but then move into the 1800s? Is that really the how
yeah,
it all happened?
Yeah. And, you know, they weren't as concerned with protecting their artifacts. And I would see some of these helmets just dry up and fall to pieces. And it was so sad. Back in the day, they just didn't do that. I would see their jerseys just hanging on hangers. And I would see the hangers literally tearing through the material because the material was so old. I've always collected with the mindset of, hey, I want to pass this along. I want to pass these relics along. I'm going to preserve it. I'm going to take care of it, you know. So I think that's a very important part of collecting, you know, taking care of the next generation of collectors.
I agree with you 100%, John. I mean, again, if we don't preserve the history of the game or anything that, you know, that is historical in nature, it's lost forever. And I just, you know, this is just an aside. I'm just kind of shocked in a way how it took so many years for football to really realize its history and to start
yep.
preserving more of it. You know what I mean? It just seems like, to me, it's almost like the past 25, 30 years that there was any urgency about it. You know what I mean? I don't know
agree.
If it's me or... You know, it's nope. I'm just floored by what I've seen. For example, and again, this is an aside. Yale University cleaned out their storage area where they had old football programs from the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and basically they just wanted to throw them in the dumpster and get rid of them. And a couple of people locally there in New Haven just said, "What are you doing? I mean, this is historical stuff." So,
well, that New Haven Historical Society, Society, they're pretty amazing. So I'm glad somebody saw that.
Yeah, I mean, it was just shocking to me when I heard it, type of thing. But again, it's amazing, and again, it needs to be preserved for its historical value, which leads us to our next question here, and seeing the stuff you have, which is just mind-boggling to me, and to Jeff. We're going to look at, try to examine your six top items in your collection, and you briefed us on it before, and I just read it about five, six times, just trying to digest it, because it's just incredible history there. So if you could, the best you can, describe to our audience your six top items in your collection.
And I feel really compressed for time. I feel like we could do this over three different discussions, but I'll do my best. So I use Park Davis.
We got plenty of time. So.
Okay. I use Park Davis, noted 19th century football historian, to help me kind of organize my collecting. So he named different periods of 19th century football. So prehistory, which was before 1869, the pioneer period, 1869 to 1875, the period of American Intercollegiate Football Association, 1876 to 1893, and then the period of the Rules Committee and Conferences, 1894 to 1904. So I tried to pick ephemeral items from each period to show my collecting interests. So I'll start off with I'll call it 1A and 1B. So I've got two paper documents. So you're gonna see that I'm mainly talking about Harvard, Yale, and Princeton in everything that I'm presenting. But that's kind of where intercollegiate football, it was kind of the center for, you know, up until the early 1890s anyway. So football at universities was an intramural sport. You know, kick a ball, you know, down a long field and try to get it over a line, probably all the way up until, you know, right around the early 1870s. And my first document is from 1820. So this is a student at Yale University, and he is the treasurer of their dorm. Back then they called them houses. So in this document, multiple pages, but it's kind of like a ledger. So he's got all the guys that lived in the dorm, and he's collecting their dues. And then he's taking that and buying supplies for the dorm. He's buying candles. He's buying wood. He's buying lamp oil. But some of the entries, multiple entries, he's buying footballs and he's buying bladders. And I'm looking at this thing. I'm thinking, this doesn't make sense. And it's foot-ball. Okay, it's not F-O-O-T-B-A-L-L. But I'm looking at this and I'm digging around. I'm like, well, where the heck is he getting these things from? And he's literally buying them from the hardware store on campus. They had to have been imported. But I know that they were using that to play intramural football, and they were using that to play kind of that entry-level game where the freshmen took on the sophomores. It's kind of like a rite of passage. So that's kind of my earliest document. I think I've read that, you know, the term football was used back in as early as the 1770s at Harvard. I haven't found anything that early, but I'm still looking. Okay, so fast forward. I've got one more document here. Are you okay if I keep going?
Yeah, keep rolling, man. It's
okay.
Awesome.
Fast forward to 1863. Okay, so now I've got a letter, a four-page letter. This kid, this junior, is writing his family. He's homesick. He can't wait to get home for Thanksgiving. And he's talking about it, you know, kind of early in the semester and how the sophomores are hazing the freshmen. So football's been banned at Harvard since 1860, but the hazing is still going on. The beatings, the taking advantage of the sophomores is still going on. And he talks about his day when he was a freshman and he played in a game and they called it Bloody Monday. I mean, he literally writes in here Bloody Monday. So the first Monday of the semester, you were required as a freshman to take on the sophomores in a football game on the Delta. So that's like hallowed grounds. In baseball, you know, that's like the Elysian Fields, or that's like the Boston Common, you know, and football was actually played on the Boston Common too. But he's talking about how in the game, the freshmen, they really didn't know other freshmen. They didn't really know who their classmates were. And somehow the sophomores corralled them and they had the freshmen beating up on each other because they thought they were beating up on the sophomores, and the sophomores were sitting on the fence drinking a beer watching them beat each other up. It's just hilarious. So that game, freshmen taking on the sophomores, you know, it wasn't about getting the ball over the line or getting the ball through a goal. It was about beating up your opponent. And, you know, they would come out of the game with bloody eyes, bludgeoned shins, torn shirts, broken bones. And I just think that's hilarious how he said, you know, in my game, you know, it was so physical, we were beating up on each other. You know, they didn't even know each other. So at the end of those games, those Bloody Monday games, the sophomores and the freshmen, they did get together for a dinner, and they actually sung Auld Lang Syne. So kind of like saying, okay, you made it through the hazing. So they called that rush, and that term rush is still used today, obviously, you know, for fraternities and sororities, but that's kind of where that right. term took hold, if that makes any sense to you.
No, that's really cool, and I've read a little bit about the Bloody Mondays, and it's so awesome you have a letter that describes one of those games. I mean, have you ever seen another one of those? Have you ever seen anything that looks like what you have anywhere else?
No, I haven't. I'm sure they exist. I'm sure that there's other documents out there, but I'm really happy to have it. I think it's pretty cool. And you know, it's one of those things where somebody really didn't know what they had, and if you don't really educate yourself and know the history of the game, you know, you kind of like, yeah, there's another, you know, piece of paper that's with scribble on it. You don't really even know what it is.
Yeah, no, that's
right.
To your point, John. Yeah, I mean, as you learn the history of football, you start to see things that other people are glossing right over, right? Because they don't have the context to understand what they're reading. And they just read it as, oh, okay, this is just an interesting discussion of an event. And sometimes it's more than
right.
that. So go ahead, proceed.
Well, these early elements of the game, they all lead up to what we play today. So, they're played on, you know, American soil. I think they're important. You know, I think some people would say, oh, well, that was a soccer game. It's really not football. Well, football evolved from rugby and association ball. So in my opinion, it is football. And I know there's plenty of arguments, when did the first football game occur? But, you know, you can't have the first football game without having the elements lead up to it, if that makes any sense.
That I agree with you 100%, and I think that's what that sometimes is lost in the arguments about it. You know what I mean? So that's an excellent point.
Forward now to the pioneer period, and you know, I'm always looking for like iconic moments in those different periods. And obviously, one of the iconic moments in the pioneer period, which begins in 1869, is the Princeton-Rutgers game. And I know this is a passion of yours, Jeff. So I'm sure we'll have a lot to discuss here, but. But how did they get to that natural rivalry, Princeton versus Rutgers? How did they get to that game? And how they got to that game was a baseball game that was played in 1867. It was quite common 1850s, 1860s for college to play intercollegiate baseball games, but it wasn't for intercollegiate football games. So one of the players on the 1869 football team was the captain of the baseball team in 1867. His name was Billy Buck. And one of the players on the Rutgers football team in 1869, his name was William Leggett, and he played on the baseball team also. So in 1867, Billy Buck's baseball team beat Rutgers' William Leggett's baseball team. I don't know. I think it was something like 42-4 or 44-0. And that didn't sit well with Leggett, and he wanted vengeance. So in 1869, he challenged Princeton to a football game, and the captain of the team, William Gummier, accepted the challenge. So I have 7 CDV size photographs. So kind of like a little larger than the Mayo set. So CDV is a small cabinet. These are graduation mm-hmm. photos, 1870 Princeton football player, Princeton students, but they played on the football team. So in this set of graduates from 1870, I've got the inciting incidents for the football game, Billy Buck, and then I've got the captain of the Princeton team, William Gummier. And, you know, to me, just to have any type of scrap from or any type of element from that game is important in the evolution of football.
Yeah, and the fact you have cabinet cards from those players is just incredible. Awesome. You got to complete that set, though. You need all the Princeton and all the Rutgers players, right?
Is that your goal?
I don't think a Rutgers image has come to market, and you know that I've seen. I'm sure they're out there, but to find anything from the 1870s, let alone the 1860s, from Rutgers is like impossible. I only know like one Rutgers image in the 1880s. So, wow. I mean, have you seen anything come to market, Jeff?
No. My eBay searches, but not that it would show up in eBay necessarily, but I don't think that search has ever hit anything other than, you know, they had reunions, you know, what, 50 years later or whatever. And you occasionally you'll see one of those images pop up from the reunions that they had, but other than that, nothing.
Well, I know that this is really really OD, really out there, but you know, I think to try to have, you know, some type of images from the players and the Rutgers players would be cool. So Princeton played Rutgers. They played at Rutgers the first game. It was a two-game series. It was supposed to be three games, but it ended up just being two because of the Princeton fathers. They said, hey, we don't want our players, you know, they're supposed to be, you know, dealing with their schoolwork and not supposed to be traveling to play football. But Princeton went to Rutgers. They agreed to Rutgers rules, which was more of a soccer-style game, can't carry the ball, can't touch the ball. And I think Rutgers beat them 6-4, something like that. And then you know, within a few days, they went back to Princeton. So Rutgers guys were smaller. They were quick. They were agile. So that game kind of you know, met their style. And then the Princeton players, they were bigger. They were more lumbering, and they played a game where you could hit the ball with your hand. You could advance it forward, sideways, backwards. You could catch it, and no interference to kick the ball. So back in the day, you could kick the ball almost the length of the field to score a goal. So, so Princeton won the second game, I believe it was, I don't know, 6-0 or something. So.
Okay. Yeah, people remember that Rutgers changed its strategy, didn't they, during the first game? Weren't they struggling and made some adjustments based on the rules? Or I seem to remember a discussion about some adjustments that were made in-game by one or more of the teams based on the rules.
Yeah, Princeton tried to bully them with their brawn, and Princeton tried to kind of corral the ball, and Rutgers was much quicker, and they made better passes. I'm sure there's other nuances there that I'm just not picking up on what you're saying, but I'm sure you're right, Jeff. Okay, kind of staying within the moving ahead to the Intercollegiate Football Association period. You can't talk about 19th century football without mentioning Walter Camp. And I know he's near and dear to your heart, too, Jeff. I'm standing in front of a 8x10 cabinet of the Yale football team, the 1876 Yale football team. Seated in the center is the captain, the father of Yale football, Gene Baker. On his lap, there is just a ginormous ball. Almost looks like a basketball, but it does have a slight egg shape to it. It's a rugby ball. And across the front, it says champions. Up above, standing in the back row, to Baker's right shoulder, is Chauncey Camp, the cousin of Walter Camp, and Walter Camp. So this is kind of like Walter Camp's rookie card. It's his freshman year at Yale. Yale won the championship. And it was kind of interesting on a very controversial play, and I know you're ready to chime in. Also in this photograph is O.D. Thompson. I think it's Oliver David Thompson. He was a great rower, but he also played on the football team. There was one play where Camp was running in for a score. He was running down the field. He's being tackled, and he throws the ball forward to Thompson. Thompson catches it and runs for a touchdown. And there was a lot of controversy. Princeton stopped play. They contested the play, and I guess the rules that they agreed on, it was kind of vague, and it went to a coin toss, Yale won the coin toss, and the first forward pass occurred in 1876. I think it's a neat side story. Am I telling that right, Jeff?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, it's great trivia, right? Who threw the first legal pass in football history? Yeah, that's an awesome story. And a coin flip, since the ref couldn't decide what the correct interpretation. It's kind of interesting, though, that I can't recall if there was tightening of the rules after that to thwart that behavior or what happened thereafter. But obviously the forward pass didn't really catch on then until the 1900s when the rules started to change. Yeah.
I think you have a program from that game, the Harvard-Yale game, 1876. I do, too. Mine's not in great shape. I think yours is in really good shape.
Yeah, and so many classic players in there that you just mentioned. You know, Camp there, and his you said I think it's his cousin, right? Not versus his brother, younger brother, cousin. O.D. Thompson, of course, played pro, you know, for a while. He's one of the early pros, you know, that pops up in some of the annals of pro football, and there's just some great names on those teams. Baker, of course, is there. Just awesome stuff.
Okay, well, I'm going to stay in that period, and I'm going to talk about Lamar's run. Maybe some people have heard of Poe's run, a run that Arthur Poe succeeded in to beat Yale in the waning minutes. I don't know, was it 1898 or 1899? That's Lamar's
right.
run occurred in 1885. So a lot of the newspaper writers of the day said it was the most exciting moment in college football up to that point. So I'm standing in front of an Imperial cabinet, a team photograph like a hard backing. It's a POC image, and it's got all the football players from 1885, and the captain of the team, Charlie DeCamp, is holding the ball, and along the ball it says Champions 1885. Along with this Imperial cabinet, I've got 14 individual player cabinets, and they're in uniform, all the players on the team. And I know this isn't the earliest kind of team set per se, but it might be one of the most complete team sets. I know there's images of Yale players from the early 1880s, but if anybody has a complete set. So, you know, I really love the Fox brothers, the photographers. They were the photographers of the Ivies and Army and Navy. But they had a way of taking a picture and making these little guys, they were little guys, especially in today's standards, and making them look bigger than life. They took these photographs to make these guys look like heroes. And, you know, featured in this would be a young Hector Cowan. I already mentioned Charlie DeCamp, but also here is a cabinet, individual cabinet, and in the team cabinet, Tilly Lamar. The captain and the running back, Lamar, they are standing next to a totem. And this totem ends up being a Revolutionary War cannon that buried on Princeton's campus behind Nassau Hall. So it's still there to the day. But the game was so important to Princeton, they won the national championship. They hadn't beat Yale since 1878. You can just feel in these images, you can feel the college pride. You can feel that this was a big moment back in the day. So basically, Tilly Lamar was the great running back for Princeton. Yale had him stymied the whole game. They scouted him well. I think he gained like a maximum of 3 or 4 yards in any given play. Yale has the ball on Yale's 40-yard line. And it's kind of like a fourth down situation. It's less than 2 minutes. They decide to bury the ball deep in Princeton's field, and they punt the ball. The three backs are back, Lamar, Savage, and I'm going to forget here. anyway, they punt the ball to the three back, and they're lined up kind of one side of the sideline, the other side of the sideline, and in the center. And it goes to Toler away from Lamar. It caroms off of Toler's shoulder across the field, and Lamar picks it up on a dead run. So most of the Yale players had surrounded, had run to Toler, so there was only two players left that could have possibly tackled Lamar. This is the waning seconds of the game, and it's Harry Beecher and Captain Peters. So Beecher and Peters are chasing Lamar down the field. Beecher's about to close on him, and Lamar just makes a move towards the center of the field and then back down the sidelines. And Beecher, he was a young player. He basically does a cartwheel. He just totally stumbles. And because he did that, it had to change Peter's trajectory, and Lamar made it to the end zone. They kicked the extra point, and they beat Yale 6-5. So the cool things about this, the significant thing about this was the first national championship game on a campus. It was on Yale's campus. A lot of the people that were there, they thought Princeton had lost. So a lot of Princeton faithful left angry. Yale faithful left happy, thinking the game was over. And they read the next day in the papers, it was an amazing comeback, and Princeton won. The people that were there, the Princeton fans that were there, they rushed the field, and they basically stripped Lamar naked. They tore his jersey, his shirt off, and they tore it up. And there's written reports where his jersey, his pieces of his jersey and his T-shirt are in scrapbooks. I've never seen or heard of one, but I'm on the lookout for a scrapbook that would have a piece of Tilly Lamar's jersey.
Yeah, that's awesome. Wow. Today that would have all ended up on eBay, right? His whole uniform in tatters.
Right. Yeah, it'd be slabbed, you know. So
yeah. Exactly.
So I think you know, that's a pretty iconic moment in 19th century football, and I'm honored to have the opportunity to share that with you guys.
Yeah, I noticed right up front of your collection there, I love those photos, the Jim Robinson, you know, the trainer. And you sold me your double of that image. I love that particular image of Robinson and the story around him and the team.
He's kind of like the beloved father figure, trainer, coach. There was no coach back in the day. The players were the coach. But anyway, there's a little card at Robinson's foot, and it says "Trot Up." And if you're familiar with the book Football Days by Bill Edwards, Big Bill Edwards, he wrote about his beloved trainer, and that "Trot Up" was Edwards was a horse trainer before he was a people trainer and athletic trainer, and the "trot up," that was just his battle cry. He would just stand on the sidelines and try to get the boys, you know, get them going, and he would yell "trot up." So if you didn't know what that card meant, it just adds more interest to the image.
Yeah, no, that's a great story. I love that story. And it really adds context to that picture. That's so cool.
Yeah. Okay, where am I with things? Okay, so you can't have a 19th century football collection and not talk about the Flying Wedge. So the Flying Wedge was a kind of a culmination of all these different mass plays. I think these mass plays started around 1884 with the V-trick. I think one of the players at Princeton used it, and he was a student of military military tactics, you know. But, you know, later on in the 19th century, they did other mass plays like the horse neck or the flying interference. The flying interference was a play ran by Yale, and Heffelfinger was the lineman that would pull. So basic mass plays means I'm going to take, you know, seven or eight of my biggest guys, my beef, and I'm going to run them at your weakest point in the line. I'm going to try to open up the line so the back can get through. So that's kind of the theory behind the mass plays. So I'm standing in front of a letter written by the inventor or the father of the flying wedge, Loren Dielin. I've not seen another signature of his, but this has football content. So I like it because it's not like a signed check or a signed letter to Aunt Millie. He is coming home. He is writing a letter. Hey, I just finished help coaching the Yale 11. So this is a period right around 1896-97 where him and Walter Camp are collaborating on a book called Football. So it's kind of like if you can't beat them, join them story. So in 1892, Harvard unveiled the flying wedge against Yale in a failed attempt to beat them. They lost the game 6-0. But, you know, for the listeners, the flying wedge was basically the quarterback was at the 45-yard line, kind of in a position to kick the ball off or start the play. And five players were lined up to his right, five players were lined up to his left. And they all took a running start, and they converged in a V shape at the ball. And the second that they kind of met, then the quarterback snapped the ball or put the ball in play, maybe kicked it with his foot. It went to one of the players, and the player flipped it to the running back. I think it was Brewer. And they advanced down the field. I think it was at the player – I think his name was Wallace. They advanced at the weakest link in Yale's line, and they moved the ball to the 20-yard line. And Harvard newspapers, after the game, basically said if Brewer hadn't flipped, it would have gone for a touchdown. They actually didn't score on that, but the point of that is after they unveiled that flying wedge, every team in the country was doing it the following season. And then that's when a lot of the injuries really, really mounted and, you know, caused even deaths. So, you know, you can't have a 19th century collection without, you know, talking about Lauren Dillon and the Flying Wedge.
Yeah, I know you're a big fan of Frank Hinkey. You know, I know there's stuff written about him and, you know, his disregard for his body. He was a small guy, but what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, is he would just like dive over top, dive in the middle, and he would do almost anything to break up some sort of play like that if he could.
Yeah, the only way to defeat it was to jump on top of the guys. You're right. And you had to have a disregard for your body. You're right.
Yep.
Yeah. And there are reports where Heffelfinger, to break up these type of mass plays, I mean, he would almost cannonball at the – he would dive in the air, and he would go knees first at these guys to break up the play like a bowling ball, you know. So pretty dangerous.
Yeah. I kind of want to wonder what you think of. So today it seems like the trend of the NFL is like when you're close to the goal line, the running back gets the ball, and then everybody behind him like grabs him and tries to push him into the end zone. And it almost seems like the inverse of the flying wedge. Like the ball carriers in the front, and everybody's behind them, like pushing and grabbing and dragging. I just wonder how long they're going to let that occur. You know, that just seems to me like we're going back to this kind of behavior. You know,
I can't believe somebody hasn't been rolled up on and torn like an ACL or, you know, had a really bad injury. Because you see guys go down when they're pushing like that.
Mm-hmm.
You're right.
Yeah.
That's a good connection there. How am I doing on time? Can I mention one other kind of A and B here?
Bob, how are we doing?
Yep. We're almost we're down to 6 minutes.
Okay.
So,
all right. So I have a program here. I have a program here and a ticket stub. It's Harvard versus UPenn. And this program relates to William Henry Lewis. So first African-American, All-American, first black coach. He was definitely a pioneer in the early 1890s. He was a very honorable guy. He was much maligned, attacked many different ways, and he kept his head up and kept moving forward. So in the Yale-Harvard game in 1893, the captain of the team, Waters, was injured, and they had to play UPenn 5 days later, and they had to find somebody to run the team, and they went to Marshall Newell, and Newell was always kind of the reluctant warrior. He declined, but he suggested that William Henry Lewis be the captain, and he was actually the captain of the team his last two seasons when he played at Amherst. So this wasn't a new position for him. So he ran the drills in practice, and the reporters of the day reported, hey, this looks like a different team. There's a lot of pep. There's a lot of organization. And sure enough, that pluck, they beat UPenn. I don't know. I think it was like something like 26-4. But the significant thing about this program is you can see in the program where Captain Waters is kind of removed or scratched out, injured, and the word captain is written next to William Henry Lewis. And to me, that's a pretty cool thing, you know, in Harvard history, in history of 19th century football. The other item that I have of William Henry Lewis, which I have a few, is a book that he published. It's called A Primer of College Football, and it's signed by him, and it's dedicated to kind of like the equivalent of the athletic director at Harvard. His last name was White. But the great thing about that book is there's like 22 photo plates of William Henry Lewis doing different moves. So this is a book, A Primer of College Football, you know, how to play the game back then, strategies, offense, defense. But to have, you know, 20 images of William Henry Lewis doing certain football moves is really, really cool. I know that's a rare book. I haven't seen many, if any. I think there's one in the College Football Hall of Fame, and that's kind of where I found out about that ball and how I wanted to get that book.
Wow. That's amazing. Have a cabinet card of William Henry Lewis?
Say that again.
Do you have a cabinet card of him?
I do not. I'd love to have one. I've got plenty of images in kind of programs, but I don't have any, and I don't have a cabinet card of him.
Yeah, there's always some things that you regret not bidding on or missing on. Before I really understood his significance in the 1800s, I was just starting to dabble in that area. I know a cabinet card of his came up on eBay.
Whoa.
And I Googled it, looked at it. I was like, wow, this guy looks like he's kind of important. Kind of half-heartedly bid on it, got blown away. And I always regret that because, you know, every time his name comes up, I think, oh, my gosh, what was I doing? What was I thinking? This guy is iconic. Totally missed on it. I've never seen it. I don't know who has it, but there was one floating around.
We all have those stories. And, you know, thankfully, there's always something around the corner the next day to take our money, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, I always tell people when they miss something, you know, don't worry. You know, either another one will roll around, even if you haven't seen it for a decade, or something else you really want will roll around. So just be patient, you know.
Yep.
Hey, we're down to 2 minutes. So, Jen, I hate to do this. Final thoughts, final comments. We're only halfway through the script, so that's truly amazing.
Well,
what you got here.
I guess I'm sad that I didn't get to touch on the four Poe brothers. I didn't get to touch on the bloodbath game, national championship trophies, the rise of UPenn, the four-time All-Americans from the 19th century. So, you know, there's a lot more content that I'd be happy to share with you guys. Maybe we'll do that on a rainy day. We'll just talk to each other. So.
Well, I think, you know, anytime you want to come back on, I'm more than happy to have you back on and talk because it's just incredible. It's the history of the early game of football. I mean, it's just truly amazing to me. Truly amazing.
Yeah.
All right, we're down about a minute. John, I hate to do it, but thanks for being on. And,
thanks, John.
We're going to wrap things up here. And hopefully I do want you back on and finish up what you were talking about before that was left over from this program. I have no 2-minute warning. We're pretty much out of time. Check out our website, gridirongreatsmagazine.com. Jeff, in 10 seconds, what'd you pick up on tonight's show?
Iconic items for iconic periods and times. I love the way John collects. It's so cool. I'll leave it at that.
It's just living history of the game. It's incredible. Truly incredible. Blows my mind. Again, real quick. Over the years, the collections I've viewed, both online and in person, from people just amazes me, truly amazes me. We're out of time. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week with another show.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network. Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour. How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.